Hey everybody, my name is Damara West and I'm founder of Be Well Beautiful Woman, where we help women to center their liberation and joy so that they can lead and live their lives on their own terms. I'm so glad that you have joined us for the Women's Liberation Summit. I have an amazing guest in the lineup that we are going to learn a lot from. And before I do the formal introduction, make sure that you're staying connected to our work in some shape or form. Follow us at the letter Be Well Beautiful if you're not already doing that. And then check out our work as well at Be Well Beautiful Woman. So let me tell you what you are in for today. Helena Vesic is an amazing, 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 amazing yoga teacher, Ashtanga. Am I saying that correctly? Beautiful.
Yes.
So she has this beautiful sacred practice that she's been engaged in for many years. And after 4 years of doing her PhD work in political science at York University, which is based in Toronto, she decided to walk away and dedicate herself to teaching Ashtanga yoga full time. She's been teaching since 2014 and is now leading the evening Mysore program at AYCT. Alongside her husband, David Robson, Helena teaches workshops and retreats in Toronto and around the world. Helena first came to yoga through dance. As a former ballet dancer of 16 years, the structure and rigor of the Ashtanga yoga practice felt like home. Drawn to the discipline, mindfulness of the movement, and emphasis on the breath, Helena made the Ashtanga practice her sole focus in 2009. Helena has maintained a daily Ashtanga practice for over a decade. She's made 2 trips to India to study with her teacher, Sharath Hoyce, and hopefully I'm saying that correctly. In addition, Helena has also considered herself and currently considers herself to be a student of Jack Kornfield, a Buddhist teacher and clinical psychologist. She's completed his and Tara Brock's The Power of Awareness course and is now enrolled in their 2-year mindfulness meditation teacher certification program. Lastly, Helena's true passion lies in promoting rescue and adoption of street dogs, and you can often find her sharing her love for Adoption Don't Shop hashtag on her Instagram and sharing the joys of living with her 2 fur babies, Buxen, and hopefully I'm pronouncing that, and Connie, both celebrities within their own right. Helena, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Damara. I'm so honored. I'm really, really deeply touched by your invitation to be here.
Of course, your work is so important and how you approach your work. And then just seeing just the sacred nature of doing it with your husband has been really beautiful to see in motion. So, you know, I'm really curious to get us started on what made you decide there had to be something like really pivotal for you that made you want to walk away from that PhD pathway into teaching Ashtanga full time.
Yeah, I think there was sort of two things. So I've already been practicing for quite some time, and it's what made me stay kind of grounded and what allowed me to, you know, survive academic world and finish my master's, which took 3 years, and then, you know, kind of be my PhD. And then at some point I was studying social justice, and I was looking at the Indigenous communities here in Toronto, not in Toronto, in Canada, and looking the way capitalism has transformed the social relations and all the oppression and the ongoing social injustices that are faced within the communities, and the way that the communities are trying to reclaim the independence, the power, the authority. And in doing so, I spent a lot of time with my friends who live in the communities, who are Indigenous, and spent a lot of time there, not just to kind of learn from them and do my work, but also a lot of time with them as my friends. I would just go up there for the weekends and be in the community and even go hunting with them. And I am a vegan and a very big vegan activist. Or I would say not activist, but anyway, but at some point there was this really big disconnect between me sitting behind my computer, typing about all of these oppressions, about all of these injustices, both historical and ongoing. And even though I was teaching at university as a TA and I could share that, I felt like something was missing. You know, I I was well aware of my position, of the privileges, and somehow it felt disconnected. And then I thought, maybe, you know, in this yoga community, in these wellness communities, people come because they want to do better. They want to be better. They want to be more awake to everyday joys and sorrows. And so I thought, if I can, you know, be more present there and offer people the technique and teach them what I know, maybe that was the way to move forward.
Yeah.
And so it was like a combination of those two things that, you know, and then my body also screaming. I mean, I would sit at and at one point my whole arm would just go numb and I would have like a freeze in front of a computer.
Yeah. And,
you know, like your body tells you something.
Yes, yes.
And so I feel any one of us that has a mindfulness practice, whatever that mindfulness practice is, at some point you can't ignore the signs that are coming from within.
Yeah.
And you either have to do something about it or I don't know. I for me, the only option was to do something about it.
Yeah.
That's where I made a decision to quit PhD and give myself fully, you know, to teaching this tradition and something I deeply trust and believe in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, the beautiful thing is that you're that call to action that led you down this pathway, not just from in physical form, but also in mental form. You were being called in a lot of different ways to step into this body of work, to heal yourself and to heal communities. It sounds like who have historically, you know, been left behind, right? A lot of these practices are indigenous practices that are often disconnected from the teacher, right? And so to hear you say, this was the pathway by which, this was a sacred pathway for me. And I love what you said. Even you said, I even went hunting with my friends. And what that tells me is that there is immense humanity in how you show up, right? You are a vegan, you embody that. You even said vegan activism, right? And which I love that because that's a part of your identity. And there are other identities that are, you know, connected to the people that you love. And the fact that you allowed space for that, which then allowed space for this emergence to occur, which was Ashtanga. And so I love this so much. And you said it, right? Like we have these moments in life where we are called to act and you, but you also indicated it was a choice. You made a choice. And for you, that was such a pivotal moment. And now you've built this expansive Ashtanga business as a result of that call to action. And I'm sure you couldn't have imagined that it would be what it is today.
Oh my God, absolutely not. And thank you for those kind words, first of all. That was really beautiful of you. And I really appreciate it, the way you said it. Yeah, it was very scary. And it took a lot of time and a lot of kind of, I don't want to say like courage, but I mean courage is like letting myself really be vulnerable, mm-hmm. and kind of maybe fall apart a little bit,
yeah.
in order to allow for this change to happen. Because, you know, I've been in academia for so long. Like, you know, first I did the undergrad and then the 3 years of my master's work plus 4 years. It shapes you so much. And it's like what you mentioned, that identity that we take on. And then, you know, walking away from it was part of like letting go.
Yeah.
And letting go is, I mean, it's never easy. Hence why it's always a practice in all of the traditions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I started having ideas about quitting my PhD probably 2 years into it. And then it took another 2 years and working with a therapist, which I'm extremely lucky to be able to have and afford, mm-hmm. To finally summon up enough courage, you know, and walk away. And I remember my therapist at the time said, quitting might be the most liberating thing you do. And I was like, what? I was like, no, yeah. Quitting?
Sure. Well, because I'm sure at the time for you, that felt like death because you had this pathway chartered for yourself. And even though you knew 2 years in, as you said, that this felt very disconnected, right? You started to question things. But I also appreciate that you said that it took you even more time, even though you had been questioning and toiling with it. You are talking about erasing, or at least it feels like erasing a part of yourself to enter into something new that is completely unchartered, you know? But it sounds to me like when you think about where you are now and this immense abundance that came about through alignment, and you said, right, you had to allow yourself to be vulnerable. And so often we don't think about vulnerability as the antidote, right? The antidote by which to draw into our purpose and to be really successful within that purpose, because that's the flow state, right? Like, but we can't get to this space of authenticity without spaces of vulnerability, an immense vulnerability, so that, you know, we get to show up more, and so that the people that we're called to reach, they get to show up more as well, right? And they're drawn, they're attracted to that.
Absolutely. I think for me, you know, whenever I do women's circles or like retreats, I just did like a day long online retreat with Jack Bornfield, and all of these places, and you know this too, like they always ask you to set intention, like sort of at the start, and something just for you to carry. And for me, over and over again, it's been softness. Softness. And I think to me, that's like another way of looking at vulnerability, where it just gets you out of that very rigid perfectionist, I got it state of mind, which of course sometimes is absolutely necessary in how we succeed. And especially for us women, we have to even exercise more of that rigidity sometimes, and, you know, kind of be very like, no, I can do it on my own and independent, more so than we probably need to sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that vulnerability or that softness just then allows for that space and a little bit more of like freedom where you can hold these paradoxes. So I can be a vegan activist. I can be very vegan, but I can also go hunting with my Indigenous friends and honor that and see the beauty and the sacredness of something like that. Like, you know, and it's not even a ritual, it's a way of life.
Yeah. You know?
And so I think that's what comes with vulnerability. And of course, Brené Brown is like the queen of, you know, vulnerability, and she talks about it over and over again, finding it. And it's an ongoing practice.
Yes.
You know, yeah. It's not like, oh, I found it. It's there. No, you like constantly have to like tap into it, and it's always scary and there's always resistance, but you kind of have to keep playing with it, and it's liberating.
Yes. Oh, I love that. I love that so much because, you know, so often when we're working to heal, you know, whether we're consciously seeking healing or not, there's this recognition that there's a journey, right? And that there, what you know to be true about yourself today, which is, you know, the highest version of your liberated self in this moment, there's a recognition is that there's more. Right? There's always going to be more, because the longer that you practice, the more that we live and have different experiences, because there are endless ways to create expansion for ourselves. And I love what you said about like how you show up in the world, because so much of that is what it means to be a yogi, right? Yes. And so often we talk about being on the mat, the asanas, even your draw to yoga was rooted in the breath and was rooted in movement and was really rooted in the collective experience of what our body holds. And so I love that from a philosophical standpoint, you really embody that in practice. And that's not always practice. present with yoga teachers that are out there, and even ones that are very well known for the work. And there's no judgment about that. Like, it is what it is. But the fact that you have invested so much of just living this way is just, it's really beautiful, because that's the essence, right, of what it really means, at least one of the aspects of what it means to really embody a yogi lifestyle.
Thank you. That's really, again, so nice of you. And I really want to emphasize what you said, because you said it so beautifully, but that collective experience. And I think that's what so often we forget. And like now when you said it, the way you said it, it sounded like, oh my God, yes. And we don't emphasize that sometimes maybe enough, because any mindfulness practice that we come to, you do it alone, and you hopefully do it for yourself at first, but it's always supposed to be done in a community setting, or we keep coming back to the community, you know, to Sangha.
Yeah.
And that's what holds us, and that energy. And that's what we really discover all of these teaching, including the idea of interconnectedness and how we are all parts of each other. And that someone else's suffering is my suffering as well, and someone else's joy is my joy, and that, I mean, they're really hard practices to hold on to, but I really like that emphasis, because yeah, like as a dancer, when I came into my first yoga class, movement was familiar, you know, and that's something that I was drawn to from childhood, but it was that emphasis on the breath.
Yeah.
And what you said, emphasis on the breath in the room with others, that just kind of was the hook.
Wow. Oh, that's so lovely. So lovely. So this is a good segue into, you know, that, and we talked about it in your bio, that the draw that you had to, become an Ashtanga teacher. But it's a different draw that many people have to a yoga practice. And for you, it was dance. And years ago, I went through a training called Yoga as a Peace Practice. And it's offered by the Black Yoga Teachers Alliance. And that was one of the things that they introduced to us, right? It dance and breath, and then asanas too. But normally this is not the way in which we approach teaching about yoga. And so I love that that was your pathway. And I would enjoy being able to explore a little bit more about that draw.
Yeah, it was, you know, what really drew me to Ashtanga was two things. So we have this, it's called, for people that are in yoga world, they'll probably maybe know, it's called Tristana, but it's three places of attention. So you have asana, which is what your body's doing in the moment. You have a gaze, so where you're looking when you're doing either holding a pose still or moving. And then we have the breath. And so those are the three points. And so when I am being taught, or when I'm teaching in the room, this is all I say, right? I will say, inhale, lift the arms up, look up at your thumbs. That's it. And then I'll say, exhale, fold down, hands on the floor, look at your nose. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing else. It's a very clear and simple instructions. And what came out of that for me at first, and this is why I was so drawn to it, was everything that was in my head was becoming loud and clear.
Wow.
Because no one was telling me how to feel or even where to feel it. You know, no emotions were being mentioned, no opening up and flowering this way or that way. Like, I have nothing against those cues for people that are drawn to it, but the simplicity made it very clear to me, and I could actually have my own experience.
I love this.
And then the other part, Ashtanga is done in Mysore style. And Mysore is just another name for self-practice. Mysore is the city in India from which our lineage comes from. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you walk into the room and you put your mat down and then you start your practice. You have your practice memorized and then you go through it. And as you progress or as depends what happens that day, if you have time, you don't have time, but there's a set sequence and you go through it as much as you can. Mm-hmm. And so you're in charge. Yeah. You're in charge of your breath. You're in charge of how you move, and the teachers are there to help and adjust and guide, but really it's you. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's empowering.
Yeah.
And humbling.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so what just occurred to me is that the Ashtanga practice is actually a trauma-informed practice without the intention of the trauma-informed lens.
That's a very, it can be.
Yes. I mean, and of course, when there are certain elements around adjustments and things of that nature, but from a philosophical standpoint and the way that people begin practice and the way that you describe the state of being and being connected to whatever things are coming up for people while they're on the mat, that's a really different way of framing yoga, right? And I love what you said. It's not in its totality, because the way in which the teacher shows up in that space is critical. But that was something that really, really stood out to me. So did you know that when you embarked on this journey?
That's a very good question. And I don't know if, I think I just like that I was being put in charge. Mm-hmm. And I like that there was one-on-one relationship with a teacher, meaning that the teacher and every single assistant in the room knew how far I went into my practice. Mm-hmm. Each day I walked into the room, they would say, hi, how are you? So there's like this check-in.
Yeah.
If I had anything happening, I can let them know. You know, if I didn't sleep well, I can let them know. If something's hurting, I can let them know. As I practice, if stuff comes up, I can let them know. And then when the tears come in practice too, I can just sit there and let the tears be, because the space held it. It allowed for these difficult emotions to be present in the room as well. So it wasn't just rainbows and unicorns. You could see people having a hard time. You could see, even if you didn't know, you could sense it. Like, we're human beings. We can feel when someone next to us is having some kind of different energy, when they're having like a hard day or whatever is happening. I think we can sense that. I really do.
Yeah.
I think when we're on our mats and we're practicing, we're all a little bit more vulnerable, and we like drop down, you know, mm-hmm. some of our masks and some of our walls kind of, you know, maybe we don't take the wall all the way down, but we take it down a notch. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so at first I didn't know that, but then as I started studying it more and eventually going down the path of becoming a teacher, it absolutely is trauma-informed practice, or it can be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so beautiful to hear you describe the Ashtanga space and how healing and liberatory it is. And of course, if you've studied yoga at all, we know there are tons of benefits, right, to getting on the mat. We know this. But there's something that this particular yoga philosophy amplifies that feels much more visceral than other practices. How is that landing with you?
I think that's true. I agree with that. And I think it's because you don't walk into the class and then there's a teacher in front calling out poses and you have no idea what's coming up. You're kind of, you know, surrendering yourself to them, which is also a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. But when you walk into this space, you are in charge. Yeah. It is your practice. The teachers are there to guide you and to help you. And too often, I read this like long time ago in one of Alan Watts books, but teachers are like these objective eyes. Mm-hmm. And at times, like, you know, when you don't believe in yourself, the teacher is there to kind of just gently kind of say, come on, you can do it. Like, they can see sometimes what we can't see. Mm-hmm. And I just feel that the main thing is that you're in charge. You decide to show up. You're choosing over and over again to do this. And then because of this relationship that you have with your teacher, and hopefully with the rest of the people in the room too, it creates such a sense of community. It creates such a safe space where we can be ourselves, you know, for better or for worse, and learn how to, you know, hold that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just so powerful. And it goes back to something you said earlier about the simplicity of the practice, right? And like, so often I think where we go astray in from a practitioner's role is when we are not allowing people to have the space they need to promote their own sense of healing, right? And so we know, of course, the asanas, breath, the movement, all of that certainly helps to promote that. But there's something much more fundamental, right, that is connected to the ability to heal thyself, right? As you go deeper into the practice. And that I think is really, I'm having this very deeply enlightening moment around this. And even though I've studied yoga and I'm a yoga teacher and I'm trained in trauma-informed yoga, just to know about the practice and how you show up in this. And it's just really deep. I can feel it. It's a visceral feeling around the power and the possibilities and just a reaffirmation of the power that of practice, right? The power of practice for our own liberation.
Yeah, it's, you know, like yoga and all the Buddhist texts teach us, like body is always in here and now. And so is the breath.
Yes.
And so this is why we use our body and we use our breath. It's the fastest way to kind of drop from here into here.
Yes.
Yeah. So when, you know, I show you a pose and I teach you a pose and I say, now you do it and hold it for 5 breaths. I don't count the 5 breaths for you. And so in order for you to count the 5 breaths, even though like in between the breaths, you might be planning something, you're thinking about what you're going to eat or like, should you buy that coat or not buy it?
Sure.
You'll have to come back and say 3, you know, to yourself, 4.
Yes.
And so it's that constant, like it really, that's the empowering part. It teaches you that you can do it, that it's within you. It was always within you. And then it allows space. Yeah, the trauma and trauma-informed teaching has only recently become more popular. Mm-hmm. And it, I mean, finally.
Yes, right? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Finally. And so one of the things that here, the way we teach, and again, I learned this from my friend, and she's a psychotherapist, and she's the one, when we do intensives here in Toronto, she's the one that teaches the psychology of the space, mm-hmm. what is happening in the space, and the psychology of the interaction, and, you know, of everything related to our practice. And one thing she always emphasizes is that no matter who walks into the room, the one and the only assumption you can make about someone is that they have trauma.
It
is the safest assumption to make. And whether they choose to share what that is or they never ever tell you that, the way we approach and interact has to be informed by that. So, you know, the very first time I touch someone, I let them know that I'm going to touch them, you know, and in the meantime, they've had to see the room. They were practicing in the room. So they've seen me that I touch a certain way and that everyone's touched. So that becomes normalized. The idea of asking for permission, permission being given, that's a daily thing as well. You know, I don't just ask you once and then take it for granted.
Yeah. I love that. Well, and you know, just the whole idea of consent, right? And I was just having an interview with someone else on the lineup, and we were talking about how we don't spend enough time really shaping consent, and that we have endless opportunities to help ourselves and to help, you know, individuals who are younger than us, in their, to really be able to have permission, right? Every step of the way. And so I love that you said that, right? Even though you're the teacher and it's your space, what you're saying is that, no, this is our space. We're co-creating this every step of the way. And yesterday it might've been okay that I touched you, but today maybe it's not okay, right? Maybe it's not okay.
Exactly.
And I love what you said about just the only assumption that we should ever make, I love this, is that everyone is coming in with trauma. And one, that helps to humanize it, right? Yeah. And two, it what it says is that this is a space, it's a healing space. And whatever it is that you're bringing, I am here to support you and to guide you in the way that makes sense for you. So that's really beautiful. So, you know, we've been talking about liberation. The whole summit is dedicated to liberation. And I would love for you to just say what liberation means to you and the way in which you're embodying liberation in your life right now.
Ooh, that's a loaded question. Wow, that's, what is liberation? I think liberation... Well, you know, first of all, we live in a society that's extremely unjust. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think if our mindfulness practice isn't bringing us closer to wanting to do something about it, something's off.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
My liberation isn't complete until everyone else around me is liberated as
yes.
well.
Yes.
And until we're all truly equal, you know, and we're talking about race, we're talking about social injustices of all kinds. We're talking about social inequality in terms of income, mm-hmm. And poverty levels, issues that pertain towards women liberation, trans liberation. And then there's climate change injustices that are happening in the way, you know, certain groups of people are being affected. Mm-hmm. So liberation for me is almost like a being mindful, you know, it's this idea of mindfulness where you are present for whatever it is happening in the moment. And then from there, you also respond.
Yeah.
To whatever is happening. So you are in service mm-hmm. of not just yourself, but others.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is so good, right? Before you'd share with us like how you're embodying liberation in your own life, you said something so powerful. If our mindfulness practice isn't moving us to do something about the injustices of the world, then we are doing something wrong. That was just so powerful and, you know, illuminating again, like when we heal, we don't heal and liberate for self alone. We heal and liberate for the good of the world. And you're right. If we're missing that part, then what are we doing? Like, what are we really doing? What is the purpose? And it's really become selfish. And then in that way, healing really does become selfish when we are not at a point of doing something about it. That was rich.
I draw from inspirational works of so many people that have done this before mm-hmm. us, that have left a legacy of work for us to follow. And, you know, like two names come up, bell hooks mm-hmm. and Thich Nhat Hanh, who,
yeah.
you know, both of them, unfortunately, kind of, we've just lost both of them, mm-hmm. or in another way, we've been, you know, we didn't lose them. Hopefully all of us start to read them more and embody the teachings that they've left.
Yeah.
But, you know, just the other day I was sharing with a friend, Thich Nhat Hanh, one of my favorite things he says is compassion is a verb. And so if compassion is a verb and we're sitting and we're meditating and we're cultivating mindfulness and compassion, that also means we have to act on it.
Yes.
And so it is like acts of love. And And then again, that's why I thought of bell hooks and all of her work about love and the way love and practicing love, genuinely practicing it, is a way to you know, get at the world that is, there's so much domination in the world.
Yeah.
If we are to end it, it's the work of love.
Yep. Yep. I love that. Right. And that's what, you know, any student that came through the Course in Miracles, that's, you know, the opposite of love is fear. And so if we're not, and even if we're, you know, like afraid to share our light, right? We don't feel, right? Because more than likely, if we're doing healing work, we've had a lot of moments when we've been pulled, right? We felt passionate about something. And maybe it is simply that we're afraid to share that because we're afraid of judgment or whatever it might be. And still, the world needs us. I can't imagine, right? Like the thousands of people that you've touched through your work. Could you imagine if your healing didn't extend beyond just yourself? We wouldn't have gotten the good gift of you. And because there are no real, that nothing is new under the sun, right? Yeah. Our job is just to pass it forward. But without light bearers like you, light bearers like me, or anyone else who's listening, then who passes the work forward? How do we grow this? How does it stay alive? How do we, extend even beyond the lives that have already been touched by this? Because we have the power, right, to do that. And so that was so beautiful. And just this recognition that, you know, you're not the first person to come with this, but you live it. You live it. You live it. You practice it, and you work to embody it day in and day out, which, in part, I imagine, is very much connected to your liberation.
I try to. I really do try my best to practice it. And I always fail and, you know, mess up. And then I have to figure out how to do it again. But it is, I think what you point to, it is scary too, you know, to stand up and make a claim, to stand up against any injustice. Mm-hmm. The moment you do that, there'll be negativity coming your way, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's coming from people too that are caught up in their own trance of fear and insecurity and hate, and where all of that is then being projected and thrown onto us, who are standing in our own truth and speaking not on behalf of each other, each other, and especially not on behalf of people who are being oppressed or are going through difficult times, but standing in solidarity.
Yes. Yeah.
And showing support. But it is scary because stuff does come our way.
Absolutely.
And so you just have to be kind of, you know, sometimes you react. I react all the time, you know, and then you have to catch yourself and realize that you reacting then is projecting back more negativity, and that's not the way to go either. And so we have these incredible teachers, some who are past, some who are still with us, who continue to show us the way to, you know, stand in love.
Yeah.
Speak up against injustices of all sorts. And I think that's a difficult practice, but I don't see any other way.
I love that. It's difficult, but this is the only path forward. Yes. So beautiful. So talk to us a little bit about the way in which you're embodying liberation in your life right now.
Oh, all right. So my practice is one way that I, you know, when my students or when people ask me, what is your practice to you? It's sort of like a daily check-in.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it's my seated practice and, you know, I am there, or my moving practice, which is my Ashtanga practice, so moving meditation, both let me kind of... I heard this term the other day from Jack Kornfield, but he heard it from someone else, but it's like flossing your mind. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, clearing all the little things and seeing all the things that are always in there. Some we notice, some we don't, some are like repetitive. They're like, you know, oh, okay, here comes this, and after this, this is going to come. And then, and so there is liberation in that, and just being able to sit and not identify with your thoughts, even if it's for 15 minutes,
yeah,
but realize that you are not your thoughts. And just breathe with it, you know, and hold your anger, hold your tears, hold your doubt, or the opposite also, hold your joy, yeah, and love, and happiness, because we don't do that either, right? As humans, mm-hmm, we kind of like, we dwell on everything that's negative. But in my practice daily, I can see that. And so that's liberating in a way. It frees you, even if it's for like a second or 2 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Sometimes that's all it takes, right? Sometimes that's literally all it takes for us to have these miraculous shifts, if that's what we want to coin them to be, you know? So that was beautiful. And I love the simplicity of what you have said, which is a theme throughout this entire summit, that, you know, people don't want to give tips on, you know, I'm not going to tell you exactly what I've done, what my self-care practices are. I want to talk about the way this is embodied, right? I want to talk about that this is very individualistic. And what you're offering also is just the accessibility of wellness practices. And so often, again, this is where we, you know, like, even though we know we can do long practices, we could do an hour class, a 90 minute class, and there's real power, right, to a 90 minute class, but there's also real power to getting into your breath for 1 minute, right? Like, there's also, so the fact that you said this, and the flossing, right? It's the day-to-day kinds of things. It's every thought. It's embodying this as an ongoing practice, because no matter how long we practice, again, there is no real arrival around this. And if we're approaching self-care with, you know, the checkoff, then we're really missing the essence of what it means to embody well-being, which, as we both know, is our birthright.
That's so beautifully said. And I really like your idea of, like, you know, people go, okay, now I'm going to go for my yoga practice, check, or I'm going to go and do my seated meditation, check. And then we think it's done. But it's not. And so I like this emphasis on recognizing all of these traditions tell us, like, once you're off your cushion or your mat, the real practice begins. But what if we also remember that we can practice informally throughout the day? And so the other night, my mentor, she was a student of Thich Nhat Hanh for over 12 years and has spent time with him. And one of the things he always reminded them was, whenever you see a stop sign, that's your reminder to take a breath.
Yes.
And so it's a very, like, it's nothing. Like, you're at the stop sign here. I don't know, here in Canada, the rule is like, we're supposed to stop for 3 seconds, mm-hmm, or so.
Mm-hmm.
But what if for those 3 seconds, we can just really notice our breath? You know, our body's been breathing this whole time. We're breathing all the time. Mm-hmm. But how does that change? Like, when we just take those three breaths, or if we're stuck in traffic, or we're in an elevator, in the grocery store, whatever it is, like these little moments, and then at home too. Yeah. It doesn't have to be this huge practice. Like, people overwhelm themselves all the time thinking like the only way to make it worthwhile is if it's like an hour and a half. And so it's not true. Like, sit at the edge of your bed at the end of the night, and just for 5 minutes, sit there and kind of come back to yourself. Well, that's your practice.
Yes, yes. Oh, I love it. I love it. And this is why you are so good at what you do.
Thank you.
Yes. So as we get ready to wrap up, I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about how deeply connected, like, you are devoted to the practice of yoga. And it came out, of course, in your bio. And, you know, you've been to India twice, right? To study with and to have an immersive experience. So talk to us about, you know, what, outside of what you've already shared, what has yoga done for you to help you to live a liberated life, you know, what's the hype about for you? And hype might not be the right word. I mean, but hype in the best sense. Hype in
but
the best.
No, I totally get yeah. what you mean by it. And I kind of like it. Like, what's the hype? Like, okay. Why do you do it on the days that you don't feel like doing it?
Yes.
And you know, you're tired and it's been a difficult day and mm-hmm. you know the tears are coming and you still decide to do it. I think, so one, going to India and being part of the lineage is really important to me because it's not Yelena yoga or Yelena and David yoga. It is yoga that comes, you know, I can go and name the teachers and I am just another human in that path, in that lineage. And to me, that's liberating too, right? That thousands of people have done this before me. Thousands of people, not thousands, millions of people are doing this with me now too. And I can kind of surrender myself to the tradition. There's something bigger and greater than me, and I can let go a little bit. And this is where, for me, Ashtanga is so powerful because the sequence is set. Mm-hmm. It's given to us. And we don't get to change it. And, you know, on the days when you don't have a lot of time, you just do less of it. You don't pick and choose what that day might feel good, you know. You just go in an order so that even if it, you know, invokes darkness, let the darkness be. Even if it evokes laziness, let laziness be or joy. And so being part of the tradition, having a teacher who's in India, who's learned everything from his grandfather, who learned it from his teacher, to me, that's liberating. Mm-hmm. And it feels nice to know that when people come here, the way we teach them isn't our Western interpretation of things, but it's the way we've been taught. Mm-hmm. And my husband's been to India to study with his same teacher, Sharat Joyce, for over 20 years.
Wow.
You know, and so that's one thing that I really appreciate and like about this. And then what was the second part of your question? Sorry, I totally.
Yeah, no. That was great. And ultimately what yoga has done to support your liberation.
It's made me fall in love with myself. Or is teaching me that falling in love with myself is a daily work, a daily commitment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came from World of Dance, ballet, and I was bulimic when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And so my body, you know, I had a lot of body issues. And so this practice made me appreciate my body. It made me appreciate my stubbornness, but it also made me realize I need to soften up on my stubbornness. Mm-hmm. It's this practice every day. It sort of empowers me. What I said at the beginning, it empowers me, but it also humbles me.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that makes me feel more connected to myself, to the people around me, and then to, you know, everyone, to, you know, to all the humans as us, as a community, as one.
Yeah, yeah.
Without sounding, you know, like cheesy or.
No. In fact, I would say that in, you know, all of the articles I've ever read and through my training and, you know, this is the way that you talk about it, that yoga, that your practice helps you to fall in love with yourself every day as a practice, which is such, I've never heard it talked about that way. And when you think about that, like what more is there, right? What is more important than the ability to love thyself, which helps you to love other people?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's all it is. If we can't be compassionate and loving to ourselves, and I mean, that's the truth of it. We all have really hard time with that. And it is a practice. And of course, it's like, it's a Buddhist practice. It's a yogic practice, like meaning we have to cultivate it. So that's freeing to know that.
Yes.
But I think once we can start to slowly be more kind to ourselves, then of course we're going to be kind to others. If you're having a good day, you're not going to be rude to someone. Mm-hmm. And if someone's being rude to you and you're having like a good day and you're just content, you're just going to turn and walk away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of stop that trance of whatever they're caught in.
Yeah.
And, you know, they might have their trauma, they might have whatever it is coming up for them, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think then the other part of the practice too, in terms of liberation, is that it makes you accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, you have to do the work. You can't just say, well, I'm triggered by so-and-so. It's like, being triggered is not nice, and I feel sorry that, you know, I am triggered, but now I have to do something about it. How do I become untriggered?
Yeah.
And so it's an invitation to constantly do self-work.
Yeah.
For yourself.
Absolute invitation to do self-work for yourself, period. Yeah. I love it. Oh my gosh, I can't believe we've come to the end of the interview. It has been such a pleasure spending time with you, like deeply expansive. And so what final words do you have for the audience in terms of just inspiring them related to liberation?
I would just say, find the practice that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And this pandemic has provided us with so much incredible resources that have been moved online.
Mm-hmm.
And incredible resources that are available for free too. Yeah. And so just start a practice. Start with 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Whether that's like a seated practice or a walking meditation or a yoga practice. And just do it, and know that it'll be hard, and know that like negative, difficult emotions. And when I say negative, you know,
yeah,
difficult emotions will come up, and that's part of the journey.
Mm.
That's part of it. And then through that, we learn to cultivate peace and calmness and loving kindness. And that comes too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, just look up anything online or go to the local studio and just start nice and slow for yourself.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. Again, simplicity. That's why you are just so powerful in this space. So I know folks are going to want to stay in touch with you. How do we go about doing that?
Usually Instagram's the best way, social media. And on there, there's my email too. So I can be you can email me that way. You can direct message me. And if I don't respond, just make sure to like message again and say,
you're
hey,
busy.
Yes.
Yeah. But I love that. I love that. Yeah. And that invitation, like, and the reality is that you're busy, but I love that you said like, what you're saying is that if you're too busy in the moment, reach out again, because eventually, right, that you will respond to that call to action, whatever that might be. And so
that is, yeah. And then, yeah, if you're in Toronto, come by our studio here. This is where we teach. And then my husband and I are starting to travel again a little bit and teach. And so all of that is available on Instagram. And so, yeah.
Beautiful. So yeah, that's exactly where I get inspired by Helena's work every single day. So make sure that you are following her on Instagram. All that information is going to be available to you, of course, right underneath this particular video, and probably in your inbox as well. So you heard it here first during the Women's Liberation Summit. So, so excited about continuing to bring this body of work to you, to help you to reclaim your authentic power so that you can lead and live lives based on your own authentic experience. Until next time, everybody. Ashe.